From Chicago and New York, this is Democracy Now!
But I will do all I can during the next 5 years so that no one ever has a reason again to vote for extremes.
In a landslide victory in France, a former investment banker, Emmanuel Macron, has been elected president over the far right-wing candidate, Marine Le Pen. We'll go to Paris for the latest. Then we speak to a judge in Arkansas who is facing calls to be impeached after he took part in an anti-death penalty protest just hours after he halted 6 executions last month.
The judge never loses his or her humanity. And the judge, as judge, never forgets that the law has to be followed, no matter how he or she feels about a particular issue.
Plus, we will look at the economic crisis in Puerto Rico as the island moves to close 179 public schools days after seeking bankruptcy protection. And we speak to a dreamer at Rutgers University in New Jersey who's now facing possible deportation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In France, former investment banker and political centrist Emmanuel Macron was elected president on Sunday in a decisive victory against far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. With a majority of votes counted, Macron won about 65% to Le Pen's 35%. Even though Le Pen lost, it was a record performance for her party, the National Front, whose anti-immigrant policies once made it a pariah. Le Pen had campaigned on an openly xenophobic and racist platform, calling for France to crack down on immigration and leave the European Union. On Sunday night, Macron addressed thousands of supporters in front of the Louvre Museum in Paris.
Europe and the world expect us to defend the spirit of enlightenment under threat in so many places. They expect us to defend freedom everywhere, to protect the oppressed. They expect us to bring some new hope, a new humanism, that of a safer world, a world of protected freedoms, a world of growth, with more justice, more ecology.
Macron ran on a pro-trade, pro-EU, and pro-NATO platform and will need to secure a majority in next month's parliamentary election to implement his program. We'll have more on the French election after headlines with French human rights activist Yasser Louati. In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed SB4 into law on Sunday, outlawing sanctuary cities and allowing police to check the immigration status of anyone they detain. Governor Abbott signed the law after delivering a short speech in a live video posted to Facebook.
Texas has now banned sanctuary cities in the Lone Star State. We are a nation of laws. And Texas is doing its part to keep it that way.
Critics call SB4 a show-me-your-papers bill that will lead to widespread racial profiling while preventing undocumented immigrants from calling police or testifying in court. After Governor Abbott signed the bill, scores of protesters descended on Governor's mansion in Austin. This is 18-year-old activist Yunun Alvarado.
My mom and I were both undocumented. And we've grown up in an abusive home, okay? We still live in an abusive home. And bills like this, bills like Senate Bill 4, will only make victims of domestic abuse fear for their lives even more because they'll be afraid that if they call the police for their safety, that they'll be deported and they could possibly die.
SB 4 is set to take effect on September 1st. Texas Democrats and civil liberties groups have promised legal challenges. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans have begun drafting a health care bill that would repeal much of the Affordable Care Act, though the legislation is unlikely to closely resemble a bill approved by the House last week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tasked a working group of 13 Republicans to draft the legislation, all of them white men. This is California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein speaking on NBC's Meet the Press.
I don't know what the 13 white men, when you have five Republican women who are excluded from that, that these 13 men are supposed to sit down.
You're speaking of the working group together, that has working been put together, group. And it's all male.
And it's all male. And women's health is a big part of this. And women are a majority of the population. And their health interests deserve to be contemplated in any reform.
Republicans hold just 52 of the Senate's 100 seats, and several GOP senators have said they will not accept the House bill approved on Thursday. A federal court will hear arguments today on President Trump's attempt to ban refugees and immigrants from six majority Muslim nations. All 15 judges on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals are slated to hear the case. In March, federal Judge Derek Watson in Hawaii ordered a nationwide halt to Trump's second attempt at a travel ban, ruling it likely violates the Constitution's Establishment Clause by discriminating against Muslims. President Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Army, Mark Green, withdrew from consideration on Friday after drawing fire over anti-gay, transphobic, and anti-Muslim comments. The uproar followed newly unearthed recordings, including a video in which the Tennessee Republican state senator accuses public schools of indoctrinating children in Islam, and a radio interview in which Senator Green compares transgender people to ISIS militants. Trump's first nominee for Army Secretary, billionaire Vincent Viola, withdrew in February, saying he was unable to disentangle himself from his business ties. The Senate Intelligence Committee has asked at least four associates of President Trump to turn over emails and recordings of their communications with Russians as the committee investigates allegations that Russia meddled in the 2016 election. The four officials are former policy advisor Carter Page, former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort, Republican operative and Trump associate Roger Stone, and General Michael Flynn, who was fired as national security advisor for failing to disclose talks with Russia's ambassador before Trump took office. Meanwhile, former acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates will testify to the committee today, where she's expected to reiterate that she warned the White House about former national security advisor Michael Flynn nearly 3 weeks before he was fired. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper will also testify. In international news, Iraq's military has admitted its forces bombed a school in western Mosul in an attack on May 4th that left scores of civilians dead. The journalistic monitoring group Air Wars reported the strike killed up to 81 civilians and left 86 others injured. Video posted online purports to show the aftermath of the attack, with dead children pulled from a flattened school. Iraq's army denied targeting civilians, saying it instead targeted an ISIS bomb factory. The violence came as civilians trapped in Mosul reported desperate conditions. This is injured resident Qazi Adil Mohammed.
People are hungry and starving to death. There is nothing left. There isn't any water. People are so thirsty they would drink from the well, which is full of diseases. Children and women were eating grass.
In Somalia, U.S. Africa Command said Friday U.S. Navy SEAL Kyle Milliken was killed and two others wounded as they were ambushed while advising the Somali army on fighting al-Shabaab militants. Milliken's death was the first reported U.S. combat fatality since the so-called Black Hawk Down incident in Mogadishu in 1993, which left 18 U.S. soldiers and hundreds of Somalis dead. In media news, the Sinclair Broadcast Group is reportedly nearing a $4 billion deal to purchase Tribune Media, which would give it control of more than a third of the country's local TV stations. The reported purchase comes after President Trump's pick to head the FCC, Ajit Pai, dramatically rolled back limits, capping the number of stations one corporation can control. Sinclair's chairman and former CEO David Smith is active in Republican politics and supported Donald Trump's campaign. Craig Aaron, the head of Free Press, told CNN, quote, "It sure looks like a quid pro quo. Friendly coverage and full employment for ex-Trump mouthpieces in exchange for a green light to get as big as Sinclair wants." Back in Washington, D.C., Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt on Friday dismissed half the members of an EPA scientific review board, clearing the way for new appointees from the industries the agency is tasked with policing. Among those removed from the EPA board of scientific counselors was Michigan State University professor Robert Richardson, who tweeted, "Today I was trumped." The dismissals come as the Trump administration seeks to slash EPA funding, roll back environmental regulations, appoint climate change deniers as the heads of government agencies, and defund and erase climate change programs and research. In North Carolina, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper on Friday vetoed HB 467, a bill that would have shielded factory farms from damages brought by residents sickened by hog farms. Residents have long complained about pork producers who collect billions of gallons of untreated pig feces and urine in cesspools, then dispose of the waste by spraying it into the air. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our segment on factory hog farming. In Texas, a white police officer from a Dallas suburb was charged Friday with the murder of 15-year-old African-American teenager Jordan Edwards. Roy Oliver surrendered to the Dallas County Sheriff's Office and was later released on $300,000 bail. If convicted, he faces up to life in prison. Police body cam video shows Oliver fired his assault rifle into a car carrying five black teenagers as they drove away from the officer, contradicting Oliver's initial account that the children were speeding towards him. Jordan Edwards was struck in the head and died in the hospital. On Saturday, Edwards' family and friends gathered in Mesquite, Texas, for Jordan's funeral. And in California, the Los Angeles City Council unanimously approved a resolution Friday calling for an investigation into whether President Trump should be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. City Council member Bob Blumenfield authored the resolution, saying Trump appears to have violated the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which prohibits those holding federal office from accepting payments from foreign governments.
Constitutional scholars are raising the issue that if a foreign official or embassy hosts an event or stays at a hotel where the president's name is branded from the top of the building to the chocolate on the pillows, it may violate this clause of the Constitution. The Trump Organization currently has business ventures in nations around the world, including Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, India, Argentina, and Turkey. And because of his refusal to unveil his tax returns or really any documents that explain with whom and where he does business, there are many dealings that we may never know about.
Los Angeles joins three other California cities, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Charlotte, Vermont, calling for Trump's impeachment. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Chicago with Juan Gonzalez in New York.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in France, where the former investment banker and political centrist Emmanuel Macron has been elected president in a landslide victory over far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. Macron won over 66% of the vote. Even though Le Pen lost, she received nearly 7 million votes, more than any other candidate in the history of her party, the Anti-Immigrant National Front. Le Pen had campaigned on an openly xenophobic and racist platform, calling for France to crack down on immigration and leave the European Union. Macron ran on a pro-trade and EU agenda. He has never previously held elected office, but served for 2 years as economy minister under President François Hollande. At 39 years old, Macron will become France's youngest head of state since Napoleon. On Sunday night, Macron addressed thousands of supporters in front of the Louvre Museum in Paris.
Europe and the world expect us to defend the spirit of enlightenment under threat in so many places. They expect us to defend freedom everywhere, to protect the oppressed. They expect us to bring some new hope, a new humanism, that of a safer world, a world of protected freedoms, a world of growth, with more justice, more ecology.
Paris, where we're joined via Democracy Now! Video stream by French human rights and civil liberties activist and researcher Yasser Louati. He recently wrote an article titled, French Elections, Marine Le Pen or Emmanuel Macron, Hitler or Uber. Well, that was before the election. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Yasser Louati. Can you talk about what has surprised many, the very large victory of Macron?
Hi, Amy. The victory of Emmanuel Macron is, you know, tastes very bitter to the French voters because they were pushed towards the voting booth with the National Front knife under their throat, either fascism or neoliberalism. And of course, Emmanuel Macron got 65% of the votes, but compared to what Jacques Chirac got in 2002 against Marine Le Pen's father in 2002, that was 82%. So the victory is really way below what was, you know, accomplished 15 years ago. In the latest poll from the political department of the Sciences Po Paris, which is, you know, one of the notorious political science schools, 60% of Emmanuel Macron's voters do not adhere to his program, but just voted because they had no other alternative. The abstention rate reached 16 million people, and Marine Le Pen actually got beyond the 7 million stated by Rouen, but actually 11 million people, which means identity politics and xenophobic and racist rhetoric is here to stay. On top of it, a latest poll shows that 61% of the French do not want Emmanuel Macron to have a majority in parliament, which means that a war is now being waged in order to gain a majority in parliament, and Emmanuel Macron himself will be isolated and will depend on the game of alliances. That's for the figures of his victory. As for the speech of last night, to tell you the truth, I was listening in complete dismay because he spoke about the right of the oppressed, yet we never heard Emmanuel Macron stand up against the current state of emergency, which is still in effect. When he was asked about Palestine, he said standing for the right of Palestinians to have an independent state will be, quote, taking sides. We haven't heard him speak about the 9 wars in which France is being engaged, and the list goes on. So what happened last night is only a one-night relief from Marine Le Pen accessing power, but the battle has just begun today for the conquest of parliament.
And Yasser Louati, what does this election say about the future of the established political parties in France, given that both candidates came from outsider parties?
Well, the fact that Emmanuel Macron managed to make it in 18 months from being nobody to becoming a president is a clear statement that our political system is completely bankrupt. It has capsized. There is open defiance towards politicians. People don't believe in them. It is either voting for the extremes or abstaining, as mentioned earlier. And the fact that he managed to make it to the first and then second round was also a testimony that he did not win because he was that bright or that good, but because all the other candidates were, excuse my language, let's say they were poor and not up to the task. So that's, you know, he just managed to be there at the right time and doing the right thing. So France does not need an umpteenth new president. It needs a new republic, a new constitution, a new organizing of institutions, and to actually get rid of the colonial legacy, which makes France still identify itself as a white country only. And when, for example, you hear the global press speaking of Marine Le Pen being xenophobic and against immigration, well, the black and brown and Muslims are not immigrants. They have been there for 3, 4, 5 generations, but they are still perceived as foreigners, which means there is, on top of the social war, a racial war in order to maintain the hegemony of white French people.
Let's go to the National Front's Marine Le Pen, speaking after the preliminary election results were announced.
With this historic and massive result, French people designated the Patriotic and Republican Alliance as the first opposition force to the program of the new president. I call on all patriots to join us to take part in the decisive political fight that is starting tonight. More than ever in the forthcoming months, France will need you. Long live the Republic. Long live France.
So that was Marine Le Pen. And Yasser Louati, for people who aren't familiar with French politics, not only talk about what she represents and still the rise of her party, but why legislative elections are so important that are coming up, because Macron may have won, but where is his party's representation in parliament?
Well, that's his biggest weakness. He came forward with only what he calls a movement, which means no established political party with a clear leadership. So now he's just gathering around him all the people who are either opportunistic and jumping ships from the collapsed mainstream right and left-wing parties. And on the other hand, now he's facing the challenge of having his own majority. The way our republic works here in France is that once the president is elected, he nominates the prime minister, but the prime minister can only come from the majority within the National Assembly, which means if tomorrow, for example, the National Assembly, you know, is majority under the left or an either opposing party, Emmanuel Macron will have no other choice but to nominate a prime minister from an opposing political party. And that's exactly the opportunity for those who want to confront our political system, our political elite, to register as independent candidates, because according to a latest analysis from an academic, we might see up to 5 groups in the National Assembly of France. And Marine Le Pen managed to also make her party so acceptable that people from the mainstream right party have actually colluded with her and were ready to build alliances, which means with the collapse of the Socialist Party on the left and the Republican Party on the right, Marine Le Pen will definitely get new supporters, make alliances with people fleeing mostly the Republican Party because they adhere to her agenda on identity politics, anti-European, anti-immigration, and of course this populist rhetoric to get more credibility, saying the establishment has failed you, but I will stand with you and defend you against them. One piece of information which is quite useful to know who Marine Le Pen really is: she's appealing to the working class, yet Madame Le Pen was born and raised as a bourgeois woman. woman. She is a millionaire who owns multiple penthouses, grew up in a castle in the most upscale western neighborhoods of Paris, and beyond the patriotic call of her party, she has been heavily funded by Russian oligarchs. As a matter of fact, an investigation is ongoing by various journalists on Russian mobsters financing Marine Le Pen. More news to follow, of course.
Asa Luatu, we want to thank you very much for being with us. French human rights and civil liberties activist speaking to us from Paris. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to an Arkansas judge who ruled in a death penalty case, then on Good Friday went in front of the Arkansas governor's mansion and laid down on a gurney protesting the death penalty. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with him in a moment.
Everybody's got one, and I don't know why. Who will be next? Who will be next? Sphere in the country and the levees dry. Who will be next? Who will be next? Papa, won't you tell me, is it true what they say? Who will be next? Who will be next? They're taking our weapons on election day. Who will be next? Schoolyard been pushing around. Who will be next? Who will be next? They keep on coming, gonna lay them down. Who will be next? Who will be next? These games have been playing, feel like the real thing. Who will be next? Who will be next? And I get my
who will be next? Joe Purdy. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman on the road in Chicago. Juan Gonzalez is in New York.
We turn now to Puerto Rico, which filed for a form of bankruptcy protection last week, seeking to restructure $123 billion in debt and pension obligations in the largest local government insolvency in U.S. history. The move is likely to slash money for health care and pensions and infrastructure. Over the weekend, the island moved to close 179 public schools. The territory petitioned for relief under Title III of the PROMESA law, which recognizes that while Puerto Rico is not a state, it must in some ways be treated as a sovereign. Puerto Rico is legally barred from using Chapter 9, the bankruptcy route normally taken by insolvent local governments. Meanwhile, President Trump has signed a government spending bill that included $295 million in Medicaid funding for Puerto Rico's health care system. The island's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, spoke to NPR about the public spending cuts.
I made no secret when I ran for office that we needed to reduce the size of government. We needed to be more effective. And frankly, just talking about the schools that are closing, that was part of our proposal a couple of months back. It has nothing to do really with Title III. And some of the strategies that will ensue, we've already stated that they're going to happen. You know, we need to reduce our expenditures in health care, although we don't want to reduce the access to it. We really need to reduce the expenditures in education. And what we're doing is we're tackling the bureaucracy as opposed to education itself.
That's Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló speaking to NPR over the weekend. Now, Juan, you've been following this news very closely. You write extensively about it. You've given major university lectures about it. Talk about what's happened in Puerto Rico.
Well, I think the thing to understand is that it's been nearly 2 years now since the former governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, announced to the world that Puerto Rico could no longer pay its debts. Congress and the Obama administration spent months trying to figure out what to do without actually giving any direct assistance to Puerto Rico, and finally imposed this colonial control board over the island of Puerto Rico, a board that consistently meets in New York rather than even on the island of Puerto Rico. And now we finally found out last week that the control board has reached the same conclusion that Governor Garcia Padilla announced nearly 2 years ago, that it is impossible for Puerto Rico to pay all of the obligations it now owes. And the board made clear that it's not just $74 billion. That's the number now that it has stipulated is the bond debt of the island. But there's another $49 billion in pension obligations that the Puerto Rican government has to its public employees. And it only has about $1 billion left in cash in its pension funds, which means the pension funds are essentially bankrupt. And so there's a total of $123 billion that's owed. Now, you got to understand that number. Detroit, the largest previous bankruptcy in American history, was only $18 billion. This is nine times greater than the Detroit bankruptcy. And it is a sum of money that is almost impossible to grab, to understand. And the control board further stated in a petition that when it requested a federal judge to come in, that the island is poised to lose $850 million this coming fiscal year in federal Affordable Care Act funds, which means its Medicaid system will be further in crisis, and that that the island will lose $16 billion over the next 10 years as a result of changes in the Affordable Care Act. So basically, the situation is going to get worse. So what did the control board do? It said that even if Puerto Rico has more austerity, and the austerity we've already reported on the degree of austerity that is occurring, that even with all that austerity, over the next 10 years, there will only be, at best, $8 billion left over from annual budgets to pay the bondholders. The bondholders are owed $35 billion over the next 10 years. So that means the board is saying, essentially, there's only 25 cents on the dollar available, even with massive austerity, to pay these bonds off. So predictably, the bondholders went crazy. They've been going to court. And now the control board has asked for Chief Justice Roberts did appoint a judge now, Judge Laura Taylor Swain from the U.S. District, Southern District of New York, who is now going to be the judge in charge of deciding exactly how much money the creditors get and exactly what happens in Puerto Rico's future. So this has now gone from a U.S.-appointed control board now to a federal judge who essentially is in charge of the economic future of Puerto Rico and how much the bond, the creditors will be paid. And obviously, the creditors are challenging the PROMESA law, which has created this bankruptcy process, as unconstitutional. So there are constitutional questions, since this law was only passed last June by Congress, that still have to be resolved. We're looking at years of litigation while the economic condition of Puerto Rico continues to deteriorate, and the fundamental issue of that this colonial situation between the United States and Puerto Rico is no longer viable. It is economically impossible to sustain is the issue that will have to be resolved over the coming months.
And finally, Juan, the significance of almost 200 schools closing in Puerto Rico?
Well, this there's no doubt that some schools needed to be closed because Puerto Rico has lost almost 200,000 students. It's gone down from a high of about over 500,000 to about 300,000 because of the continuing flight of people from the island, especially young couples with their children. So there's been a huge drop in the public school population. However, the level of closing of schools is unprecedented, and there's even talk, some of the control board has been asking for furloughs for teachers, which means of 2 days a week, 2 days a month, which means two less days of school for public school children. And in addition to that, the control board has been asking for about $450 million in cuts to the public university system of Puerto Rico, which the governor is trying trying to reduce the level of the cuts and the increased tuitions that would result from that. So there's a huge crisis in the educational system of the island. That's only going to continue to push more and more people from Puerto Rico to leave the island.
Well, Juan, we're going to link at democracynow.org to all of our coverage of what's been happening in Puerto Rico, and as well as the student protests in San Juan and different places around bankruptcy, around the moves that are going on both in Washington and in Puerto Rico. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Chicago. Juan Gonzalez is in New York. Juan?
We go now to Arkansas, where the state executed four men in April, marking the first executions there since 2005. Arkansas had initially planned to execute 11 men during the month of April, but several of those executions were blocked by the courts. One of the judges who blocked the state's efforts is now facing calls to be impeached. On April 14th, State Judge Wendell Griffin issued a temporary restraining order halting six of the executions over concerns that the state used false pretenses to obtain a key drug slated to be used in the executions. Following his ruling, Judge Wendell Griffin took part in an anti-death penalty protest outside the governor's mansion organized by his church to mark Good Friday. In addition to being a judge, Griffin is an ordained Baptist minister.
Calls for Judge Wendell Griffin's impeachment began soon after photographs from the vigil appeared in the press, showing him lying down on a cot with his hands bound together as though he were a condemned man on a gurney. The state's high court soon barred Judge Griffin from hearing cases involving executions, capital punishment, and the state's lethal injection protocol. Then last week, lawmakers set the stage to impeach Judge Griffin. If they succeed, Griffin would become the first judge ever impeached in the state of Arkansas. While Wendell Griffin's future as a judge is in question, he has opted not to stay silent. Today, he joins us in his first national television interview. Judge Wendell Griffin, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about your actions, your ruling in a death penalty case, and then going outside to protest outside the Arkansas governor's mansion? Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Juan. First of all, let me correct the narrative. The case in which I ruled was not a death penalty case. The case involved a complaint by a distributor of a pharmaceutical product, a drug, that had that drug obtained by the Arkansas Department of Corrections under false pretenses. The drug was obtained, and the distributor sought to get the drug back. The distributor filed a motion for a temporary restraining order on Good Friday, the afternoon of Good Friday, shortly before I was going to attend a prayer vigil that our congregation had scheduled in front of the governor's mansion. Based on the law that governs contracts and property, basically property law, I found that the distributor had a case and that the distributor's chance of having its property returned was likely to be destroyed unless I entered temporary restraining order. I entered a temporary restraining order, went to the prayer vigil, and the ruling was incorrectly reported as a ruling as blocking executions. Actually, the effect of the temporary restraining order was to simply hold the status quo, to simply say to everybody, listen, do not dispose of this drug until we can get all of the parties before me and we can sort this out, whether or not the Department of Corrections correctly has the right to hold this drug, or whether or not this drug, in fact, was wrongly obtained. The evidence before me showed it was wrongly obtained, and so I did what I was supposed to do. Now, I also went to prayer vigil. That's what I'm supposed to do. I'm a pastor. Good Friday is the religious holiday before Easter, when followers of Jesus commemorate the death of Jesus. Our congregation had planned to have our Good Friday observance in front of the governor's mansion before this motion was submitted to me. And so, as a pastor, as a follower of Jesus, I went to the Good Friday prayer vigil, and as a follower of Jesus, in solidarity with the religion of Jesus, I lay on a cot to show my solidarity with Jesus, who was a condemned man, condemned by the Roman Empire to death. And so that's what happened.
Judge Griffin, were you surprised by the firestorm that followed your participation in that vigil and the calls for your impeachment?
I was surprised that there was such a refusal to even ask about the facts. The case, as I mentioned earlier, was not a death penalty case. It was a case about the return of wrongfully obtained property. I was surprised that people did not understand that no matter what my views are on the death penalty, the law on the right to get your property back is the law on getting your property back. And no matter who the judge is, that law has to be followed. As a matter of fact, after the Arkansas Supreme Court removed me from the case, the judge who took that case after me heard the same case, heard the same facts, and ruled the same way. So the issue is not what one's view is or what people want one's view to be about capital punishment. The issue is whether or not a judge will follow the law, regardless of how he or she feels about an issue. I did that. Now, what surprised me is that people who claim to believe in the integrity of judiciary and judicial independence now somehow believe that judicial independence is a threat, so that they believe that judges who follow the law should be impeached. That surprises me, and really it disappoints me.
Judge Griffin, Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge told KTHV it was inappropriate for you to participate in the Good Friday protest against the death penalty. She suggested it impacted your decision to grant a temporary restraining order on the use of the execution drug. This is what she said.
Those actions are inappropriate, and that's why we have asked the Supreme Court to vacate Judge Griffin's temporary restraining order, and that it is inappropriate for Judge Griffin to be on this case.
And Judge Griffin, State Senator Trent Garner questioned whether your views on the death penalty threaten your ability to be fair and impartial as a judge. This is Garner speaking to Fox 16.
Making a public statement of protest for the governor mansion is unacceptable. It's a disgrace to the judiciary system.
So I wanted to get your response to both of these people, Judge Griffin, and also if you can describe the scene outside the Arkansas governor's mansion when you did lay down on that cot.
Let's talk about the scene. First of all, members of our congregation were present at the governor's mansion. There were also other persons present, other persons who were protesting the death penalty. They all had a right to be there. Our congregation had no right to chase off other people, and other people had no right to expect that our congregation would not be present. In fact, our congregation led the protesters in singing "This Little Light of Mine" and "Amazing Grace." Those are songs of our faith. And so we did, as a followers of Jesus' congregation, what we had a right to do. And as a judge, I did what I had a right to do as a citizen by practicing my faith. That's not disgraceful. That's American. That's democratic. We believe, because of the First Amendment, that every person has the right to live out his or her conscience. As a judge, I have an obligation to follow law. That means that when a case comes before me, I have an obligation as a judge to apply the law that applies to that state, no matter what my personal views may be on an issue. It is not disgraceful for a judge to have views one way or the other way about capital punishment or anything else. It is not disgraceful for a judge who holds views to hold those views and decide cases involving those issues. What is inappropriate is for people to believe that when a judge decides a case according to the law, he or she should somehow be suspected as not being faithful to the law simply because he or she is faithful to their faith. Faithful to faith and faithful to law are not mutually exclusive terms. We can be faithful to our faith and faithful to the law, and the law can be followed even when we, as a people of faith, find questions about the law. And I think that's something that we have to understand. Now, let me speak about Attorney General Rutledge. Attorney General Rutledge represented the Department of Correction, the governor of Arkansas, and the director of the Department of Corrections in the lawsuit in which the distributor was trying to get its drug back. If Attorney General Rutledge believed that I was not qualified to decide the case, she had an obligation as a lawyer to bring that issue up before me. She didn't do so. She did not tell me she was bringing the issue before the Supreme Court when she did that. The Supreme Court did not tell me that it was considering Attorney General Rutledge's motion to disqualify me when it did so. The Supreme Court did not give me an opportunity to tell the Supreme Court what the facts were before it removed me from the case and disqualified me from hearing all death penalty cases in Arkansas, any case involving death penalty. And that's unfair, because no matter how thinly you pour it, every pancake's got at least two sides. And part of what a judge is supposed to do is hear all the sides. It's unethical for judges to refuse to hear the sides simply because one side doesn't want the other side heard. And it's unethical for a lawyer who's supposed to be representing the judges, the Attorney General of Arkansas represents judges, to basically go behind a judge's back and try to have a judge removed without even telling the judge that she's doing so and giving the judge opportunity, a chance to hire their own lawyer and set the record straight on what the facts are. So I'm not concerned about my conduct. I'm very concerned about the conduct of the Attorney General and the conduct of our Supreme Court, because ethically, our justice system depends upon people trusting that our officials will follow the law. And when the Attorney General of Arkansas doesn't follow the law, when the Supreme Court doesn't follow the rules that say that every dispute must be heard by all sides, people are going to have questions. If they will not follow the procedures when it affects a judge, how can they expect the procedure to be followed when it affects people who are ordinary citizens? So I'm concerned about that, and I think we should all be concerned about that. Now, as to Senator Garner, I think that we should all be concerned about the notion that a legislator believes that there's something somehow undemocratic for people to think about issues affecting public policy. What's undemocratic about practicing your faith? What's disgraceful about living according to your faith? And what's disgraceful about following the law, even when you have to follow the law and have questions about an issue involving the law? By point of fact, I followed the law in another case involving the death penalty where I refused to allow an amended complaint to challenge the Arkansas death penalty case because the Arkansas Supreme Court had said the death penalty inmates could no longer challenge the constitutionality of the death penalty. I followed the law in that case even though I opposed the death penalty. So when Trent Garner says to me, to the world, Judge Griffin is disgraceful, I don't understand how he defines disgrace, because quite frankly, by following the Supreme Court's ruling, I disprove his claim of disgrace. By following the Supreme Court's ruling, I disprove Attorney General Rutledge's notion that I can't follow the law. And by not allowing me to tell the Supreme Court that, the Supreme Court basically has prevented me from letting the record be made clear.
Judge Griffin, this is not the first time you've been involved, obviously, in controversy over your personal views. You've been as you're a native of Little Rock, Arkansas, you've openly voiced support for raising the minimum wage, for opposition to the war in Iraq, and in opposition to the demonizing of immigrants and LGBT people. Could you talk about the reactions you've gotten in the past to your personal views?
Thank you, Juan. I think really that is what we're really talking about here. The issue is not whether or not I follow the law on Good Friday. The issue really is, and I think Trent Garner has made this very clear, Senator Trent Garner has made it clear, he has a long-standing objection to the fact that Wendell Griffin as a person and Wendell Griffin as a judge holds views about public policy and life that he finds objectionable. I believe that people should earn a living wage, and I'm not afraid to say so. I believe that it is wrong for us to demonize immigrants, for us to pick on our LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for us to marginalize people because they are different. I supported marriage equality. I am glad that we have finally in Arkansas embrace the notion that all persons are entitled to live out their love openly and honestly without being demonized for it and having to be forced to live in the shadows. There are people who find my perspective on life and on faith abhorrent. They have a right to do that. But they don't have a right, as public officials, to punish me or to try to punish anybody else simply because they disagree with what I view life should be. I think that we as public officials have a responsibility to honor the freedom in this society to disagree. That's a wonderful thing, and it is something very dishonorable. We have a word for it, tyranny. Something very dishonorable when we use power to punish people with whom we disagree. And so this issue involving impeachment is nothing that I need to think about other than simply the latest effort to punish a judge, a black judge, I will say it, a black judge with whom the white power structure in Arkansas disagrees. And I am a black judge and a black preacher. And just like the power structure disagreed with Martin King and found him objectionable, the power structure in Arkansas disagrees with Wendell Griffin and found me objectionable. But I think that the important thing for me to remember is if I'm to be faithful to the law, I've got to follow the law no matter whether people agree with me or not, or whether people approve of me or not. If I'm going to be faithful to my faith, I've got to live true to my faith, even if people find my faith objectionable and even if they're willing to punish me for it. And I've got to be willing to say, if you want to punish me for my faith, I'm going to live out my faith. And you can decide whether to punish me.
Judge Griffin, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Judge Wendell Griffin, judge of the Sixth Circuit for Pulaski County in Arkansas. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Chicago. Juan Gonzalez is in New York.
We're joined now by Mike Lowell, civil rights attorney. He's one of the attorneys representing Judge Wendell Griffin, the Arkansas judge who is facing calls to be impeached for participating in an anti-death penalty protest. Can you talk about how unusual it is for a judge in Arkansas to face impeachment?
Sure. Let me just say first, thank you very much for having me. And I'm just one of the attorneys that represents Judge Wendell Griffin. Also on our legal team is Mike Matthews of Foley and Lardner of Tampa, Florida, and Austin Porter of Little Rock, two great attorneys. How rare is it? It's extremely rare. The latest version of the Arkansas Constitution was adopted in 1874. So in almost 150 years, there has never been an effort to impeach a sitting judge the way that they're doing here with Judge Griffin. And I think that, you know, you really got to like kind of put this in context here. A lawyer smarter than myself recently said to me, normally when there is some type of a race against time involving an execution, that race against time is to save a life. Well, not here. This was a race against time to kill people before drugs expired. So I think it's important to always kind of see this entire kind of situation through that prism. Going on after Judge Griffin's always kind of a challenge because he's so eloquent and he covers the bases so well. But let me just recap a bit here. Judge Griffin followed the law. On Good Friday, that TRO, or temporary restraining order petition, came before him. And it sought to maintain the status quo so that these property issues could be settled. Again, McKesson claimed that the false pretenses were used to get the drug. This was the conservative thing to do, and the judge heard the petition. The elements were satisfied. The complaint was verified. Affidavits were attached. The movement alleged imminent risk of irreparable harm. When you check those boxes, you're supposed to grant the temporary restraining order. And that's what he did. The fact that it involved the paralytic in this kind of breakneck-paced execution schedule by the state of Arkansas is really immaterial to his decision. So, this is a witch hunt of the first order. Judge Griffin has been singled out because of his history of outspokenness, his history of advocacy on social issues, and this is just another attempt at trying to take him down, like so many attempts before.
And so what happens now? The significance, if he is impeached, the first time a judge in Arkansas would be impeached, Mike Lowe.
Yeah, I mean the possibilities are frightening and staggering. This is such an extraordinary measure that they're taking here, and it really speaks to the naked political motivation behind these maneuvers. This happened on Good Friday. The TRO was entered on the 14th. Later that evening, but literally hours after that, vigil and the rally there at the governor's mansion. Moments after that, you heard state senators and state representatives taking to the airwaves and making statements impugning Judge Griffin and threatening impeachment a mere hour after this protest. And that really speaks, I think, to the zeal and the rabidness with which that they are kind of approaching this matter. It's clear that they're trying to take Judge Griffin down. They saw an opportunity to do so, and they wasted no time in doing that. The problem
I want to thank you very much, Mike Lowe, for joining us, one of the lawyers for Judge Wendell Griffin. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is on the road. I'll be speaking at Philadelphia Free Library tonight at 7:30. And then tomorrow in New York City on Tuesday and on Wednesday at Seattle Town Hall and Washington State. Finally, on Friday, we'll be speaking at the New School. You can check our website at democracynow.org. Then we're on to Beaverton, Oregon, and then going through California next week. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by many remarkable people. And I want to give special thanks to David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
pretty faces, you've got a lot to live for. You dress the street up and take me on a fancy walk. And your reflections in shop fronts aren't for buying, but they're window shopping and you can't blame them for trying. Silence is easy, 'cause pictures don't have to talk. Words flowing freely when the world is in your look. But I like shadows under eyes, crooked teeth and worn down smiles. Legs not built.